It's not a new sentiment that corporations have shifted away from thinking long-term and focus more on short-term results, that companies are only concerned about the bottom line. This short-term, bottom-line approach has resulted in a negative impact on people and the planet, and yes, even the corporations themselves. Today on Circular Stories, we meet an executive slash author who wants to see companies change this approach. Well, today we are joined by Jackie Dryden, who is the Chief Purpose Strategist at Savage Brands, which is a branding and marketing company. And Jackie's also the co-author of the book, Get Your Head Out of Your Bottom Line, that is. So Jackie, welcome today.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm so glad that you were able to join us. It's been an interesting week,
indeed.
You know, post-election. So I want to get right into it. First of all, give me a little bit of background on what you do and the company.
Well, Savage Brands has been around for over 40 years. Started out as a design and marketing company into advertising and branding and all of those things. But a few years ago, we realized that the conversation was changing, that people could buy a logo online for $40 and people could get their nephew to do their website and they could take their camera on their phone and take pictures and go, done. Why do I need you guys? And we realized that we wanted to be more involved in the conversation about how companies grow, to make them be stronger and more successful as a business, and not just be about what it looks like or sounds like, not just about the visuals and the communications, but to get more ingrained into the operating parts of companies so that they could have enduring success.
So you're looking at the bigger picture.
Indeed.
Okay, I like that. I like that. So the book, Get Your Head Out of Your Bottom Line, is a very, very interesting reading. And I have to say, I wanted to have this conversation around the book and around these larger issues that you address in the book. And, you know, you kind of start out by talking about, you know, the problem with equating shareholder value, you know, that focus on the bottom line with success. So, you know, what has that meant for people, for, you know, for employees, for shareholders, for just companies in general, you know?
Well, Jack Welch, who was the CEO of General Electric, was one of the ones who came up with the shareholder value equation in the very beginning. And then as time went on, he said, I think that's a terrible notion. I think that's really destructive to believe that quarter by quarter, the success of your business is dependent on how many people are buying or selling your stocks, puts you not in the driver's seat, but actually in a reactionary position of trying to please the marketplace, rather than looking at what you stand for as a company and connecting with people at something more tangible and more profound.
So that hasn't always been the thinking, though, it seems.
No, we came out of an industrial age where it made sense to measure things by time and money. Number of widgets in per hour, number of widgets out per hour, and it was very mechanically oriented. In an age where we are more electronic, we are digital, we are about the intellectual property, that equation just doesn't work anymore. Time equals money and production equals money is a different equation. Now, it is the depth of thought or an idea that can actually drive a business.
Well, you mentioned in the book, in the chapter one, talks about how America got here. And you talk about the fact that the nation is at a crossroad, crippled by mistrust, disloyalty. Corporate America is in need of a change. How do you think that played a role in the election results? How did it kind of manifest itself?
I think there is a great parallel between these two, because less than 30% of a company actually trust the executives in their business to tell the truth when the stakes are high. We'll extrapolate that out into the political scene, and I think what you saw was a huge distrust in the status quo not really believing that what people were saying was what they believed or stood for, that it just happened to be the party line. And so many times in companies, this distrust also comes from lack of information, from non-transparency, from employees wondering what people are thinking. So I think in the political scene, much of that happened, that what we saw people saying, we thought there was subtext there that was not being said, which actually leads to mistrust.
Right. So we know we didn't start out this way. We know that, you know, that was the thinking in the past. You know, after World War II, you know, companies stood for something. You know, they made the best this product, or they, you know, provided the best service. So that's kind of fallen by the wayside somewhat.
A little bit. I mean, there are great pockets of inspiration. If you want to talk about service, you can look at Nordstrom's.
Yes.
When I talk to people and they say, oh, we're all about customer service. And I say, well, are you as good as Nordstrom's? And I don't know if you ever heard the story about the lady who wanted to return snow tires to Nordstrom's.
Right.
And the customer service person said, well, we don't sell snow tires. She said, no, I'm sure my husband bought them here. I'm really, you know that he did. And the customer service person says, well, how much would you think they're worth? And she names a dollar amount. They give her store credit and take the snow tires. Now that's customer service.
Wow. And, you know, it seems like, you know, that care for people, that concern for people, is one of the things that seems to get lost in the translation when you're talking about focusing only on shareholder value and the bottom line.
Absolutely. I don't think that you ever hear somebody run into the office in the morning and say, how do I add shareholder value to my company today? How am I going to boost that bottom line? That's why I'm here. I mean, it's... People are not connected to that. And there's this, also in the mistrust, there is this feeling that if I'm making money for my company, it's the people at the very top that are benefiting. But that is not being shared universally. There are some companies who do. If you look at Southwest Airlines, years ago they figured out if they made their employees part owners, that they would have a different vantage point for how to run that company. And I think it's just a wonderful model of when people are actually vested in having the impact, the ability to impact outcome, and they care about what they're doing, the results are totally different.
Right. Now, in the book, you talk a little bit about the millennials and how they are affecting this kind of thinking, or a change in thinking. And then you talk about the boomers and their legacy. Kind of compare and contrast those two groups and how they are hopefully contributing to the way things are changing or the way they're moving forward.
Well, many times we look at these two different generations at the opposite ends of the work spectrum and think, well, they're nothing alike. But there are some really great similarities, and they're being shown out in this purpose arena, which is the boomers, who were one of the most idealist generations that ever came along. They were anti-everything. And all the people that were against everything became bankers and real estate brokers. And at the ends of the careers, the boomers are looking back and saying, what's the legacy that I've left? What am I leaving behind? How is the marketplace and the workplace better because we were here? And there's this reflection happening and this need to leave something of value. Contrasted at the other end of the spectrum, the millennials are coming into the workforce and saying, we're not just going to hang out and show up for 40 hours a week and leave at the end of the day without feeling anything. We want to be connected to something that matters. And if we can't, we'll just go start our own companies. I'll just go be an entrepreneur and start my own business.
Right. And that seems to be a lot of what's happening. I was actually having this conversation with someone yesterday about how, you know, young people, they just get out there and do it. And what is up to us, the older people, I should say, is to not squelch them, not hinder them, but to guide and to, you know, help shape that and to help channel that into something really, really great.
beautifully said. Yes. And so I think these opposite generations that at either end actually have this in common, that they are working towards something of purpose, something of meaning. The number one reason why employees stay in a job is because they are working towards something they believe in and feeling that they are making a difference. It's not about pay and increase in salary and perks and job title and all those things that people might think. It's because they are working towards something they believe in and feel they're making a difference.
And in many cases, I think companies think that it's about the money, and that, okay, if I just pay people more money, then, you know, I can hold on to people longer, or hold on to my better people longer. And it turns out that in many cases, that's not the way it works.
It is not the way it works in most cases. That you can give somebody something, a job that they feel they have value and they understand what they are doing and they're connected to it. At the end of the day, they leave fulfilled and feeling good about what they've contributed. That will outweigh the dollar sign every day.
And that it's such a change of thinking. It's such a different way of thinking, because I think we've been taught to believe that, you know, it's money that's the driver. It's money that makes people, you know, that helps you attract the best people and hold on to the best people.
Well, think about it this way. We've been trained from a very early age to basically think, as a child, what was our job in school? To make A's, right? So why did we have to make straight A's? So we could get into college. And then, why do you need to go to college? So you can get a good job. And why do you need a good job? So you can make money. That's been the equation that we have placed in children's heads from the very beginning. So imagine if we started asking a different question of children. What brings you joy? What lights you up? What would you like to contribute to the world? When do you feel most fulfilled? And if we started asking those questions and stopped focusing so much on the trappings of it and the indications of value rather than the real value they are bringing, then we might be developing some children that can get into the workforce and add something of purpose. And when you do, the money follows.
I love that. But here's what I keep hearing, you know, in the back of my, that's pie in the sky. And,
yay,
you know, all that companies, you know, have to do is provide you a job and a wage and, you know, and that's all you should expect. How do you change that mindset? How do you change that mindset to the mindset that you were just talking about in giving kids from the very, very beginning the thought that, hey, This is your life, and it's your chance to make a difference, you know, and to really make your mark.
I think we start asking different questions, and we start letting children know that their value is not on a piece of paper. It is not, did you bring home an A or a B or a C? There's a wonderful story in Chicken Soup for the Soul called Animal School. And it's about these animals starting a school, and they all had to do every subject. And the duck was great in running, I mean, in swimming, but he was poor in running. Mm-hmm. So he had to stay after class and make up in running. And then his webbed feet got so torn up that he was only average in swimming, but average was okay in school. So it is a story about, if you're a duck, be a duck. And if you're an eagle, be an eagle. To look at children and realize what is the beauty that each individual child is bringing to the world, and tap into that and stop measuring them by what's written on a piece of paper and some arbitrary grade based on a test that somebody put together. So to me, it starts with asking different questions and inspiring children to look inside themselves to find out, what is the joy that I can bring to the world? How can I add something? And when we start thinking that way, the business world is going to change as well. And that's why I think the millennials coming in and saying, I'm not just going to show up and take a paycheck. I have to do something of value, that they're starting to get this story straight, and they're starting to get this idea that it's not what you get, it's about what you give. And when you collectively give something as a group to the world, you become unstoppable.
And that is completely different thinking, completely, completely different thinking. And I think that's one point where we can start really, really reaching young people to start asking them those questions and to ask them early on. I mean, I think, you know, I teach at the college level, so, you know, I'm privy to a lot of those conversations. But, you know, those conversations just start in elementary school.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So contrast what happens in school to my grade, my test, my GPA, my this, my that. It's all very personally connected. You go out in the work world, and now you're supposed to be a part of a team. You're supposed to be doing something together. Now figure out how you all can benefit. So we flip the thinking once somebody gets into the workforce. And there are schools right now that are being structured basically the way that businesses run and letting kids work in groups and understand how to resource and use the best of each person. I ask adults, are you a straight A adult? Probably not. Why do we expect that of our children?
That's interesting. You know, that's a very interesting concept, a straight A adult. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm A-level at cooking, and I'm A-level at laundry, and I'm A-level at, you know, driving a car. So, you know, that's a good way of comparing that. Because
imagine
the
stress.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
You have to operate at optimum in everything.
It's stressful enough as it is being average in something.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
So now, in the book, you talk about kind of the traditional thinking and the way that businesses are kind of structured and how they're organized. And you talk about how the company missions are written and they're not really connecting to anything that's meaningful. Talk about that and the problem with that.
Most companies we visit with will tell us, oh yes, we have a mission and vision and values, and we ask them what it is, and it's to be the number one provider of widgets on planet Earth, and to be, you know, such and such a size, and to be better than everybody else, and to dominate the industry. I mean, there's all kinds of superlatives. And the question that we ask after that is, how is that motivating people to want to help you get there? What is it that all of your stakeholders get from your mission, vision, and values? Meaning your employees, your customers, your suppliers, your shareholders if you're public, the communities that you work in. How are you benefiting all stakeholders? And are you making business decisions based on your mission and vision and values? Which, P.S., the two of the values of Enron were teamwork and integrity. So you can claim anything, but is it real? And we say in the book that there are two bookends missing. Purpose on one end, which is why. What is the profound reason that people can tap into and connect to and believe in? And behaviors on the other end. How do you actually bring all this to life? Because you can write a purpose, mission, and vision, and values. And all of that is rhetoric until it's connected to behaviors. Until everything you say and do align together, that they're not just words. And most companies create this mission, vision, and values, and then they put a strategy together for how to make things happen the next year and a budget to go with it, and then they tactically try to get there. We flip this 180 degrees and say your purpose should be at the point of everything that you do, that every decision your company makes should be filtered through purpose. How will that help us achieve this? How will it help us get there? And your purpose is outward facing. It's the benefit that you want to bring to the world. It's not what you want to get. Then you filter everything in your company to say, how are we like this? How are we not like this? Where are we aligned? Where are we misaligned? And then you fuse everything you say and do. So now when you decide to do something, it filters through down to your purpose before you make a decision. It's 180 degrees from the way that most businesses are actually structured and making decisions today.
You know, it's interesting because in the book you have a pyramid. And, you know, in the traditional thinking, you know, you start at the top with the mission, and that's the smallest part of the figure, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at a pyramid, you know, it's the base that's the widest, and that shores everything up, and it's the foundation for everything, you know, in the pyramid. But in traditional thinking, in your figure, the mission is at the top, at that, you know, that little bitty, you know, piece at the top.
Right.
And what is at the base is that, you know, that traditional thinking that that bottom line.
The more I do, the better it will be. I just do more. Mm-hmm. Sell more things, have more people, have more offices, get more money through the door. That's how we grow as a company.
And it turns out that that's getting harder and harder. You know, it's getting harder and harder to sell more stuff. You know, it's just, you know, who are you going to sell it to? I mean, I look at that and I think, you know, all the time, you know, is it feasible to think about growth, 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 you know, ad infinitum, you know, as opposed to development, getting better, getting smarter, getting wiser, you know, getting more effective and efficient.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you talked a little bit about the flip, but how does that work in practice? So I know that, you know, you talked about how your company works with other companies to look at these, you know, kind of more strategically, look at these bigger picture issues that we're talking about. So how does that flip work in practice when you've had this kind of approach, you know, with the mission being that little bitty bitty piece and everything else, you know, kind of just
supporting it at the bottom.
How does that look in practice? How do you help companies to say, okay, look, scratch, you know, hard reset, control, alt, delete. We're starting over again. So how does that work in practice?
Well, in practice, it is not easy. And most great things are not easy. Everybody thinks, oh, let's just do this and we'll just call it something and be done. It is actually a C-suite discussion. You need the very top of a company, those people that are running the business and setting the direction for it, to get into a room, and we spend 2 or 3 days, you know, full days with the executive team examining and looking at these things and pulling out all of the misinformation that has been fed in for a long time. I liken it to if you've taught yourself to play tennis and you're a pretty good tennis player, but you get to a level where you finally want a coach to go to the championship level, that coach is going to have to unteach some of those bad habits that you have in order to give you new habits that will take you to a greater place. So we try to get executive groups to understand why they've gotten where they are. Not that it's a bad place. We're not saying that. We don't do this work with companies that are broken. There are always companies that are already successful, and they see the need to become something even greater.
Oh, yeah. Taking it to the next level.
Indeed.
Mm-hmm, the next level.
And it is mind-boggling because you are kind of pulling through and getting to the very core of the existence of the business. And when you ask these questions initially, you say, why are you in business? Well, it's to make money, to grow, to get bigger. And then I keep saying, why? Which is what you just said. So why do you get bigger? Why do you grow? What does that do for you, everybody that works for you, and every stakeholder that touches your business? How are they improved? And what is that core reason that you went into business for the first place? Or if you've taken over a company, why was it started? What is it that you want to accomplish? And how is the world better off because you're here?
Mm.
They're deep questions, and they're difficult.
They're deep questions. And so, you know, I'm thinking, you know, about people listening to this and saying, you know what, that's cute. You know, Jackie, that's cute. That's wonderful. But I cannot, as an employee of company XYZ, I just can't see that. I just can't see people taking the focus off that bottom line to move to something higher, you know, more ethereal, you know, so to speak. And I don't know if people can actually make the connection between, you know, their everyday work life and, you know, moving, you know, to this level of, dare I say, heaven, nirvana, paradise.
Yeah. So here's a great example, because you think, oh, this would just be in certain industries that are all fluffy and this is the kumbaya marshmallow piece and everybody let's be happy and sit around the campfire. There are actually hard statistics that go with this. And Raj Sisodia and his cohorts wrote a book called Firms of Endearment.
And Raj is the...
Raj Sisodia is an academic, mm-hmm. and he's the author of Firms of Endearment.
Okay, yes.
And they studied companies for 10 years to say, how are these great companies that people want to work for that are actually successful financially and they keep their people, what are they doing? And in the process, they found out that companies that work and live with a well-articulated and visible purpose outperform the S&P 500 by 9-1 in some instances and 16-1 in others. So there's a real financial component to this. But the finance portion of it is what comes after purpose. And what I was going to do is share with you a very quick little example of a company that's here in Houston that's called Blinds.com, B-L-I-N-D-S.
Oh, yes. Very familiar with Blinds.com.
Yes. And they sell window coverings online and over the phone. And you think, gosh, what a terrible place that would be to work. I mean, I don't know if I just want to sit there and tell people to measure their windows. And you know, it just doesn't sound very thrilling to me.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, so.
Oh, that's funny.
But they give tours once a month. And it's one of the most magical places that I have ever been inside of offices because people are there energized. And let me read to you what their purpose is. Their purpose is to help people become better than they ever believed possible. Now you think, what does that have to do with window coverings? But many of the people that they hired early on were people that might not have had the education to get a high-paying job or a job that might have looked like it was better on the outside. But they brought people in to say, you can do this and it can be important. You can be better than you ever thought possible. And their call center is much like Sports Center. They have big jumbotrons and people who are selling well. Their pictures are up on the screen and there's a lot of activity and banter and a lot of helping each other. And for their customers, they want you to be better than you ever believed possible because they're going to help you hang your own window coverings, something that you thought you couldn't do, yeah. That you thought, I'm going to mess this up, and they want you to be able to do that. So although that may sound warm and fuzzy on the outside, let me tell you about success. This company is growing and growing. They've been so successful, they were bought by Home Depot. Mm-hmm. Now you might think they would become Home Depot, but instead, Home Depot saw the magic in this business, and they send executives down to Houston, Texas, to train in the Blinds.com offices to find out how they're doing what they're doing. And it's because they believe in this purpose, and they're all in it together to elevate each individual human to be better than they ever thought possible.
Wow. You know, you keep talking about purpose, and so you're, from what I understand from the book, you start with purpose. So what is the relationship between purpose and mission? Because, you know, as we said before, people typically start with a mission. Mm-hmm. So what is the relationship between purpose and mission since you're starting with purpose? How does that work?
Well, I'll give you a couple of definitions here and it will help put these pieces together. We call it your focus, which is your purpose, your mission, your vision, your values, and your behaviors. So your purpose describes why anyone would want to associate with your company, work for you, buy from you, be in your neighborhood. Why would anyone say this is a great business to be associated with? Mm-hmm. And it's usually fairly broad and it's not ownable. Like the purpose of MD Anderson would be
making cancer history.
Correct. No. They're not the only people attacking cancer.
Right.
But the guy mopping the floor in there believes that he is curing cancer. You know, that he's a piece of this. Mm-hmm. So it's a very profound seated belief. Then your mission is how you demonstrate that you are doing this every day. What are you doing day in and day out that makes me believe that you are working towards this purpose? And then your vision is this big, beautiful, audacious picture of where you're going to mm-hmm. motivate mm-hmm. other people to go with you. Yes, I see a world like that. I think it can be that way. I want to be part of that. I want to go there. Then your values are the principles that you must infiltrate your culture with to make all this be real. Mm. And your behaviors are who you demonstrate yourselves to be through your actions. How are you actually showing that this is happening day in and day out? So that's how we define those particular terms because they get mixed up all the time.
Right.
And we're not saying these are the definitive definitions. It's just the way that we have used them in the book to help people understand the difference between the purpose is why anyone would want to associate with you. And then your mission is how you differentiate. This is how you show I'm doing this differently than anybody else. This is your uniqueness.
You know, that the purpose thing, I would think that companies would want to kind of roll that out to everyone, even, you know, in an interview, even when people are just interested in finding out more about the company, you know, when they come to interview, you know, when you go for training, if they're giving you training, that purpose would be at the forefront of everything that they would do.
It certainly is. And it's at the forefront, and it's also seated inside of people. So it's not something that you necessarily need to go out and yell mm-hmm. to everyone, but it does help you figure out how to recruit, train, and retain the best employees for your company, because they're connected at something more than what's my salary, when is my vacation. And it helps you find out what clients are the best for you to work with. What are those companies that align and have similar thinking and a similar ideals to yours? Then those are going to be good relationships and more long-term. So it is a driver. In fact, the purpose of Southwest Airlines has been described in many different ways. In the 70s, it was kind of articulated as to democratize the skies,
mm-hmm.
to make it easier to fly.
Right.
And you won't necessarily see it as a tagline. It's not something that they put on, you know, on every single side of the airplane or in their brochures and so forth. But if you read the letter by Gary Kelly in the Southwest Magazine every month, you will see something about their values or their purpose or what it is that they're doing. It's infiltrated into the article, and it's mentioned every single month. So you're absolutely right. It's something that you do want front and center, but it's not necessarily a rote memorized phrase
right.
that mm-hmm. people just recite.
Right. It's just a part of who you are. It's in your DNA, right?
It is your essence.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Well, and here's where I can see that purpose would be such a good targeting tool, because it attracts the people that, you know, that can relate to that, you know, that want to be that. And I could see that being a great way to attract the best and the brightest, so
absolutely.
To speak.
Mm-hmm. If you can look at a potential recruit and say, hey, do you believe in this? Is this at the essence of who you are? Is this the difference that you want to make in the world? And they're like, absolutely, that's me. That is me to a T. They're probably going to be great for your team. If they say, I don't get it, but I'll show up if you'll pay me enough.
Right. Yeah, that's probably not the person that you want to hire. So, you know, in the book you talk about how we use the terms B2B. You know, my company is a B2B company. In other words, I do business with other businesses, right, that serve, you know, then they might have an end customer. Or you say, no, well, I'm B2C. I work directly with end consumers. You mentioned in the book looking at business as H to H, that is human to human. Talk about that.
Yes, we are not the first to talk about this, but it certainly is gaining momentum. And that is that businesses have no emotions. They don't make decisions. They don't do anything. They're kind of inert. They're run by human beings. And when companies say, oh, I'm B2B, it's not emotional, it's just all transactional, it's like, well, those people that you're talking with and those people that you are doing business with are people.
Mm-hmm.
They are humans. And if you look at the human side of it, that equation, you understand that there's something much more powerful at play here than just looking at the numbers and being transactional. And when you start thinking H to H, it's a human being to another human being or a group of human beings, it starts to have more punch and more potential to actually connect you with others.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have goals and things that they want to achieve just like you do. So,
indeed. Yeah. They get up and have a dog that's can't find in the yard, and the kid can't find their socks, and you're late for the bus, and all of those things happen to each one of us.
Right. And, you know, and at the end of the day, I mean, we've always been taught that people like doing business with people that they like. So, you know, they're going to try to find a way to connect and do business with the people that they, you know, feel a connection with. A lot of times people say, well, you know, it's just about the price. It's just about the price. You know, as long as you can give me the price that I want, you know, I'm fine. Maybe.
Yeah.
But maybe not, you know, maybe not. Maybe it's worth it, to me to pay, a half a cent more or a cent more, you know, if, especially if I'm buying in volume, to someone who, you know, really understands my business, who really, you know, wants to see both of us succeed, that, you know, that wants to raise, all the boats, so to speak.
Nicely said. Yes. That, mm-hmm. that when it becomes solely about the price, you have taken away all of the emotion with it, and it's just a transaction. And anybody can perform a transaction. But to actually build a relationship and to have people that come back and to service a client in a way that you're saying, I know this affects other people. And what we want is the best for all stakeholders involved. And that's very much the one of the tenets of conscious capitalism. Which Roz Sasodia and John Mackey of Whole Foods and a whole group of people started to say, capitalism is fine. It's great. It's the best thing around. But it needs to be done with a conscience.
Mm.
It needs to be done knowing that there is a net effect for the way that you run your business.
Right, right. So now, tell me, which companies, you started alluding to it a little bit before, but which companies are getting it right? You know, and how is that manifesting itself? Is it, you know, increased profits, a better brand value? How, you know, talk about those companies.
Yes, all of the above. I like to say that you don't go to Whole Foods for cheaper tomatoes. You go there because there are very knowledgeable people about the produce. It's an experience. And when you start thinking about what's the experience of working with your company like, you start looking at all aspects of it. And most of the businesses that we talk about are B2C traditionally in that,
right.
because we talk about Container Store and Kip Tindall and the way he built his culture. We talk about Zappos and how was built from Tony Hsieh. And his book is incredibly powerful about how he created his culture of service. And there are very many. Nucor Steel is a traditional B2B, you know, company. There are several banks that do not only consumer business, but also business to business. Umpqua Bank in the Northeast started up there very small, and then they started realizing that they needed to be experiential. What is it like to do business with us? Who is that group of people that we want to be associated with? And these are the companies that are attracting the best employees. They're actually growing at a higher pace than any other business. And they're retaining people. It is a fabulous equation. In fact, John Mackey said in one of his talks when his book Conscious Capitalism came out that companies that do not do this are not going to be around in 10 years. Because enough businesses are going to start realizing that this is more about how you elevate all stakeholders and do business with a great conscience than how much money did you make last quarter for your shareholders.
Mm. Wow. So the, you know, those are a number of companies, you know, those are a number of companies. And from what I see, it seems to be growing every day. I think, one of those publications, I think it's Sustainable Brands, you know, talks about the green giants, you know, those people that are, you know, taking a triple bottom line approach to business, you know, thinking about the planet, thinking about people, but, you know, thinking about profits because, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, with everything else aside, businesses have to make money. That's how they stay in business and that's how they continue to employ people. But I think the approach on kind of balancing that with thinking about other stakeholders, I think that thinking is getting more and more prevalent.
Yes. In fact, it is. They are linked together. That when you operate with a very profound purpose, your profits rise. So if you want to be more profitable, flip the equation and start with purpose and build your business there. And then you will find you'll associate with the people that believe in you. They will work harder with you. You will attract those clients and customers that want to be associated with you. And yes, profit is necessary for success. It is one of the measures of success. The problem is we have looked at it for the past couple of dozen years as the only measure of success.
And that has led to some issues. And this is, of course, how we got to where we are today. So now, if you're a grassroots employee, you know, you said that, oh, you know, this starts at the top and starts in the C-suite. Mm-hmm. But if you're, you know, a grass, you know, a bottom line employee, or I should say, you know, frontline employee, how do you affect change? I mean, in many cases, people might feel powerless, you know, to create this new working environment, this new type of company where we care about things more than just the bottom line. How do you do that?
Well, I think when management and the executives are very clear on why they exist and they articulate that to everyone in the company and they give them the power to make it real, that people rise to the occasion. A really quick little story is a company had done this and then they had created this visual representation of what their future looked like five years down the road from having become this purposeful company. And they created a wall inside their offices with all of these visual representations of what people would be saying, what they would be doing, what would be happening. And one of the workers there, who was a fairly new and young employee, she saw on the wall that it says that New York Times will do an article about our company. So she picked up the phone and she called the New York Times. And she said, well, somebody there is going to do an article about our company. And I said, well, who are you? why are we doing an article about you? And she said, well, this is who we are. And they said, well, I don't even know what reporter you're talking to or who is working on this. And they said, why are you calling? And she said, because it's on our wall. I said, what are you talking about? She said, well, we have this wall of this vision of where we're going, and there's all of these images up there, and it says that New York Times is going to do an article about us. And the person on the phone said, I really don't even care what company you are, but I want to come take a picture of this wall. And they came and they took a picture of the wall, and they did a story on the company. So that's how a frontline employee that says, I'm not in the C-suite, I'm not driving things, said, well, that's where we're going. Let me take the bull by the horns. Inside of our company, our IT person, who does not have necessarily client contact, asks every supplier that comes to us, what's the purpose of your company? Why do you exist? And so she is having these conversations, and it's just turning the lights on for people and letting them see the impact that this has and how it elevates everyone.
And you know, it would be wise, I think, for those in the C-suite to let people have those moments, you know, to let them have those conversations and to let them bring those thoughts about how they can make it better, how they can, you know, really impact the purpose of what it is that they're doing, even from their little corner.
Absolutely. And at blinds.com, they have two tubes in one of their areas, one of their common areas. They're two big plexiglass tubes that have marbles in them. And one is a success tube and one is a failure tube. And they like to see the failure tube being two-thirds full to one-third full with the success tube, because they know if they're not failing, they're not pushing. And so management is very much in support of that. In fact, they weave it into everything that they do, and they have this visual representation of all their failures, and they applaud them. So,
and you know, I think that goes back, now you've come full circle back to what you were talking about with kids and how we measure success, you know, or how we teach them to measure success by the number of A's that they have. And, you know, I tell my students now that one of my best students, I will say,
not naming names.
We never name names, but if she's out there, she knows who she is. this young lady, she never made higher than a B minus in my class, you know? And it's, you know, I got to know her. And this young lady was so sharp, I would trust her with my children. And, you know, and they were small at the time that she was in my class. I would trust her with my children easily because she just, you know, she just had it together. She just, and the reason why she never made more than a B minus in my class was that she was running two businesses. She was actually running her father's company. She had to be the, I guess you say, the face and the marketing behind that, because he did the work, you know, the actual operations. And she had started her own business, and she was doing, you know, very well, and she was very personable, and she knew how to get out there and engage people and talk to people. So pretty much her time was, you know, pretty yeah. locked up. And, you know, to study for all my quizzes and tests, you know, she did the best she could. But, you know, I was surprised and quite pleased that she made a B minus, you know, with what she had going on. But, you know, you just know that is the type of person who I would love to have in my company. And I probably won't, because she's quite entrepreneurial.
Yeah, she's going to have her own company.
She's going to do her own.
We'll all go work for her.
Yeah. And you know, and I could see, and she was very, very, you know, she was compassionate and she was warm and personable. And, you know, she kind of knew how to get things done, not by browbeating and not by, you know, just running roughshod over people. She just knew how to make these relationships work. And as a result, her business was growing. Her little business was growing. And of course, the family business was doing well. So, you know, it's just amazing how, like you said, those measures of success, I mean, in the end, I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're almost meaningless, although they do get you, you know, from point A to B to C or whatever, you know, in terms of grades and whatnot. But, you know, it's really, really, it would really be kind of freeing if people were allowed to not know, you know, or be expert, like you said, in everything, mm-hmm. you know. You know, if you have kids, you know, you look at them, and I've gotten to that point now where I say, okay, you know what? This is what that person is good in. This is what this kid is good in. And let's kind of optimize that. Let's you know, let that person optimize this, and this kid is good at this over here. And let's not expect them, like you said, to be straight A adults.
Exactly.
Because it probably won't happen, and people will be frustrated. And, you know, those companies like Blinds.com and all those, you know, other companies that you mentioned, you know, everybody wants to go work for those companies. Mm-hmm. You know, talk a little bit about that.
Well, when you are a very purposeful company and it aligns with what many people believe in, they want to show up and work with other people who have similar beliefs, contribute to something that they care about, and leave at the end of the day feeling they made a difference. And I think that this is life-saving. It sounds very grandiose, but imagine how much less road rage there would be, and how many people would not come home and, you know, yell at their kids because they would be fulfilled in doing what they're doing rather than frustrated and feeling that they didn't get it all done and they just never got there. I think people are working harder and longer hours and accomplishing less because they don't have their socks in it. You know, they're not committed to the outcome. They are just committed to how that provides for their family.
Mm.
But when you look at how the work you do provides for everyone, that's uplifting to you. And the story of Blake Makowski, who was on The Amazing Race and traveled to countries where there were so many children that didn't have shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, well, I could start a company to manufacture shoes, and I don't know anything about making shoes, and I could start a charity and gather, you know, money, solicit money for donations so I could send them overseas. Instead, he created what's called a for-benefit company.
Mm.
Rather than for-profit or not-for-profit, it's called for-benefit. And that is, I'm going to manufacture shoes, and when you buy a pair of shoes, you buy two pair.
Mm.
One for you to wear and one for a child that has no shoes to wear. So he allowed his customers to become benefactors.
Mm-hmm.
So you become philanthropic simply by doing business with his company. And because it wasn't just about shoes, now they do eyeglasses and safe births. But that's the kind of thinking that says, how do I add value to the world? And people love to work for that company and mm-hmm. buy shoes from that company simply because of what they believe in.
And I think that now, you know, even that thinking has evolved, right? To help people, you know, like even with the micro loans and those type of things, mm-hmm. that's what that has done, is to help people, you know, help themselves, you know, to give them the, I guess you say the base, the foundation to help themselves. You know, it's not about, you know, you're helping them start businesses in their own, you know, countries and in their own villages and whatnot, so that it, like you said, it benefits everybody. It, you know, it benefits everybody. So, you know, even companies that, you know, have knowledge to share and you know, even if it's not per se products, right? Mm-hmm. Is, you know, sharing knowledge and
absolutely,
you know, and sharing, you know, and kind of helping people get out of the muck and mire, you know, that they experience. So even knowledge sharing, I mean, and really, really caring, you know, just like you said, it's not just about what our projections look like for next quarter.
Absolutely. Right? And I feel that the life of a public company CEO is traumatic. I mean,
it looks like all glamour.
Oh yeah,
on TV,
you're at the top,
though,
and it's so wonderful. But you have a board of directors that can fire you if your numbers are bad, and you are living by quarterly stock prices.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is that we have had the opportunity to do this work in the energy sector in Houston, which you think that would be so difficult to get an energy company to think about purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have found is that it has had a dynamic difference inside of the company and outside, where people say, this is not the big bad behemoth trying to, you know, terrorize the earth, that they're actually trying to add something of value and give us energy that we can use to fuel our lives at a reasonable price and make it plentiful and make it safe. And when you start changing that equation from it's all about how much money can we make to what is it we're trying to provide to the world, it changes the dynamic for every stakeholder group that works with that business.
And you know, and here's what I would hope, that changing that thinking allows you to look at everything more holistically, right? To say, you know what, and you know, look, full disclosure, I'm a big sustainability person, but it would allow you to have the conversations about, okay, are we doing what's best? Are we doing, you know, it kind of opens the door to have those harder conversations and not shy away from it, because you've already talked about your purpose. And if your purpose is to do better, to do, you know, to, like in the case of blinds.com, to help people be the best that they can be,
mm-hmm.
it would seem like it would give you room to have tougher conversations and not shy away from them.
Absolutely. It forces you to absolutely strip away all of the exterior and get down to the core of who you are and what you stand for. And I think when you were talking about sustainability, it's like physics, that every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And understanding that every action we take as a company or as an individual in a company affects so many people. And when you get a group of people that care about that effect and want to use that for positive good for the whole, it's powerful. It,
mm-hmm.
it ties into my favorite quote, is a web of 1,000 strands can stop a charging lion.
Mm-hmm.
That every thin line of a spider's web is very delicate and fragile by itself. But if you weave 1,000 of them together, they become so powerfully strong that a charging lion cannot penetrate. And that's what purposeful companies are doing. They're weaving 1,000 strands together to stand for something that they believe in. And when they do, the impact is incredible.
And I would hope that, I mean, and I know that there are people who want to see change like yesterday, 2 weeks ago, right? Two years ago. But what I'm hoping is that with this change of thinking, you know, and looking more deeply at the way that we affect people, that we affect the planet, that we affect all these other stakeholders, that, you know, slowly people would change their thinking. But, you know, what I hope happens is that people, I know that the, you know, the time is now, but I hope that people give them space to come to the, you know, to come to those ways of thinking. You know, there are people who get it. I mean, you know, they get it. They mm-hmm. just get it. Oh, I know. I understand. But there are people who have to come to that.
Absolutely.
And you've got to undo all this, like you said, that traditional thinking. Mm-hmm. So you think about that, how that has to be undone. All that has to be undone for people to get to this place, you know, where they can do a hard reset and start thinking, you know, more and, you know, on a more higher level, you know, to create this thing that we might describe as pie in the sky.
Well, change always has resistance.
Mm-hmm.
It is naturally dynamic in the way that it pushes on you, so you push back. But when you absolutely open yourself up to the possibilities of it and quit trying to left brain it, if you think back to Malcolm Gladwell's blink, that every decision is right brain, and then you just either substantiate or refute it with your left brain. And the idea is to let your right brain out to play, to think of the possibilities of what it can be before you start editing and saying, well, we tried that before and it didn't work. That we can't do that. We don't have the time for that. We don't have the money for that. When you find out what your true purpose is, you become unstoppable, because every obstacle put in your way does not stop you. It's just something to climb over, go under, or go around.
So do you think that companies are really, really as a whole going to start following this philosophy? What are some trends? I think you started talking about it a little bit before, but what are some trends that you see?
Well, I see trends in people absolutely using the word purpose and talking about it. I don't see it being quite used in the way that we are talking about it, as something very profound that you believe in. But I think that takes time. And the trends are that the conversations have started. People are having conversations. There's more books on this. There are more people speaking about it. There are more people doing this work. And I say the more the merrier, because the more dialogue there is, the more we start to get a little bit of comfort with it, and we won't be quite so resistant.
Right. So what is it that gives you hope?
I have great hope in the human spirit. One of our purpose at Savage is to unleash the inherent good in all companies, because companies are started for good reasons. People don't start a company to say, let me just go and make a boatload of money and mess everybody else's lives up and go waltz off to my lovely home. I don't think that that's in the human spirit.
At least not most companies.
Not most.
One would hope.
and those that do, there's a lot of misery there.
Yeah.
Misery not only with the employees working there, but also the people that set out to do that. Because they will find at the end of the day that there is no happiness in that. There is no joy. There is no fulfillment. So I am hopeful that in each one of us is this desire to find the best of us and bring it out. And when people don't, when people are mean or people are cruel, it's basically a reaction to fear.
Mm.
When people are mad, it's because they're afraid. And when you can tap into what somebody's afraid of, they're afraid of not being loved, of not being enough, of not being accepted, of not being able to, of not being cared for. It goes back really deeply to what it is that we want for ourselves. And when you can pull people together and say, we can find the best in each one of us to do this together, that gives me hope.
Hmm. And that is a good note to end on today. Jackie Dryden from Savage Brands and co-author of the book, Get Your Head Out of Your Bottom Line. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And perhaps you'll come back in the future with more stories of more companies doing this very thing.
That would be wonderful. wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Circular Stories is produced by me, Rosalind Wyatt. You can email me at info@circularstories.com, and you can follow me on Twitter @CircularRoz.